The rain continued outside. It was to the same sound of rain that she had walked out of his dreams 5 years ago, and now she had returned to them, taking their child with her. He picked up the phone to call Kent, but then he heard soft footsteps outside. A woman's footsteps, but not Zhuang Yan's. Even so, he tossed the phone down and went outside. Luoji immediately recognized the slender figure standing on the porch in the rain, even though he could only see a silhouette.
"Hello, Dr. Luo,"
Secretary General Sei said. "Hello. Where are my wife and child?"
"They're waiting for you at Doomsday," she said, repeating the words in the painting.
"Why?"
"This is a PDC resolution, to let you work and fulfill your wallfacer responsibilities. No harm will come to them, and children are better suited to hibernation than adults."
"You've kidnapped them! That's criminal!"
"We did not kidnap anyone."
Luoji's heart quaked at the implications of Sei's statement, and he pushed them out of his mind rather than face that reality. "I said that having them here was part of the plan."
"But after a thorough investigation, the PDC decided that it was not part of the plan, and so took steps to prompt you to get to work."
"Even if it's not kidnapping, you took away my child without my consent, and that's against the law." When he realized who he was including in "you," his heart quaked again, and he leaned back feebly against the pillar behind him.
"True, but it is well within acceptability. Do not forget, Dr. Luo, that this and all of the resources you have tapped do not fall under existing legal frameworks, so the UN's actions in the present time of crisis can be justified under the law."
"Are you still working on behalf of the UN?"
"Yes."
"You were re-elected?"
"Yes."
He wanted to change the subject to avoid facing the cold facts, but he failed. "What will I do without them? What will I do without them?" his heart asked over and over. Finally, it slipped out of his mouth as he slid down the pillar to the ground. It felt like everything was collapsing around him, turning to magma from the top down, except that this time, the magma was burning and pooled inside his heart.
"They're still here, Dr. Luo. They're waiting for you safe and sound in the future. You've always been a sober person, and you must become even more sober now. If not for all humanity, then for your family."
Sei looked down at the ground, where Luoji sat beside the column on the brink of a breakdown. Then a gust of wind blew rain onto the porch. Its refreshing chill and Sei's words managed to cool the fire raging in Luoji's heart to an extent. "This was your plan from the beginning, wasn't it?"
"Yes. But this step was taken only when there was no other choice."
"So she was... when she came, was she really a woman who did traditional painting?"
"Yes."
"From the Central Academy of Fine Arts?"
"Yes."
"Then was she..."
"Everything you saw was the real her. Everything you knew about her was true. Everything that made her, her. Her past life, her family, her personality, and her mind."
"You mean she really was that kind of woman?"
"Yes. Do you really think she could have faked it for 5 years? That's how she really was. Innocent and gentle, like an angel. She didn't fake anything, including her love for you, which was very real."
"Then how could she carry out such a cruel deception? To never let anything slip for 5 years?"
How do you know she never let anything slip? Her soul was shrouded in melancholy from the first time you saw her on that rainy night 5 years ago. She didn't hide it. That melancholy stayed with her for 5 years, like an ever-present background music that never stopped the whole time. And that's why you didn't notice.
Now he understood. When he first saw her, what had it been that had touched the softest place in his heart, that made him feel like the entire world was an injury to her, that made him willing to protect her with his life? It was that gentle sadness concealed within her clear, innocent eyes, a sadness that, like the light in the fireplace, shone gently through her beauty. It was indeed an imperceptible background music that had quietly permeated his subconscious and pulled him step by step into the abyss of love.
"I can't find them, can I?" he asked.
"That's right. Like I said, this is a PDC resolution."
"Then I'll go with them to Doomsday."
"You may."
Luoji had imagined he would be turned down, but, just as when he had given up his wall-facer status, there was practically no space between his statement and Say's reply. He knew that things weren't as easy as that. He asked,
"Is there a problem?"
"No. This time it really is fine. You know, since the birth of the Wallfacer Project, there has always been dissent within the international community. Out of their own interests, most countries have supported some of the Wallfacers, while opposing others, so there was always going to be a side that wants to be rid of you. Now that the first Wallbreaker is out and Tyler has failed, forces opposed to the project have grown more powerful and have driven its supporters to a stalemate. If, at this point, you proposed going directly to Doomsday, it would be a compromise plan acceptable to both sides. But, Dr. Luo, are you truly willing to do that, while humanity is fighting for survival?"
"You politicians sound off about humanity at the drop of a hat, but I can't see humanity. I can only see individuals. I'm just one individual, an ordinary person, and I can't take on the responsibility of saving all of humanity. I just want to live my own life."
"Very well. But Zhuangyan and Xia Xia are two of those individuals. Don't you want to fulfill your responsibility to them? Even if she hurt you, I can see you still love her. And there's the child, too. From the moment Hubble II finally confirmed the Tri-Solaran invasion, one thing has been certain. Humanity will fight to the end. When your beloved and your child awaken in 4 centuries, Doomsday and the flames of war will be upon them. But by that time, you'll have lost your Wallfacer status and will be powerless to protect them. They will only be able to share a hellish existence with you while you await the final annihilation of the world. Is that what you want? Is that the life you want to give your wife and child?" Luoji said nothing. "If you won't think of anything else, then just imagine that Doomsday battle 4 centuries from now, and the look in their eyes when they see you. What sort of a person will they see? A man who abandoned the woman he loves most, together with all of humanity. A man unwilling to save all of the world's children. A man who wouldn't even save his own child. Are you, as a man, capable of withstanding their gaze?" Luoji bent his head in silence. The sound of the nighttime rain falling on grass and lake was like myriad entreaties from another time and space.
Do you really believe that I can change all of that?
Luoji asked, raising his head.
Why not try? Of all the wallfacers, you may have the greatest hope of success. I've come today to tell you that.
Go on, then. Why?
Because out of all of humanity, you are the only person that Tri-Solaris wants dead.
Leaning against the pillar, Luoji stared at Sei, but saw nothing. He struggled to remember. Sei went on.
That car crash was meant for you. It just accidentally hit your girlfriend.
But that really was an accident. That car changed direction because two other cars collided.
They had been planning that for a long time.
But I was just an ordinary person back then, with no special protection. It would have been simple to kill me. Why go to such lengths?
To make the murder look like an accident, so as not to attract any attention. They almost succeeded. There were 51 traffic accidents that killed 5 people in the city that day. But a scout hidden within the ETO provided an intelligence report confirming that the ETO had orchestrated the attempt on your life. And what's most frightening is this. The order came from Tri-Solaris itself, conveyed to Evans through the Sophons. To this date, that is the only assassination they've ever ordered.
Me? Tri-Solaris wants to kill me? For what reason? Again, Luoji felt displaced from himself.
I don't know. No one knows now. Evans may have known, but he's dead. He was evidently the one who added the requirement to the assassination order that it not attract attention. That only reinforces your importance.
Importance? Luoji shook his head with a wry smile. Look at me. Do I really look like someone with superpowers?
You don't have superpowers, so don't let your thoughts go in that direction. It'll only lead you astray,
Sei said, gesturing emphatically.
You had no special powers in your prior research, be they supernatural abilities or extraordinary technical skills within the known laws of nature. Or, at least, none that we have been able to discover. That Evans required that the assassination not attract attention demonstrates this point as well, because it proves that your ability can be acquired by others.
Why didn't you tell me?
We were afraid of influencing whatever it is you have. Too many unknowns. We felt it best to let things ride.
I'd once had a notion to work on cosmic sociology, because... Then a small voice deep within him said, "You're a wallfacer." This was the first time he had heard that voice. He also heard another non-existent sound, the buzzing of the Sophons as they flew about him. He even thought he saw a few blurry, firefly-like points of light. So for the first time, he acted like a wallfacer and swallowed his words, saying only, "Is that relevant?" She shook her head.
Probably not. As far as we are aware, that's just the topic of a research application that never actually went forward, much less obtained any results. Besides, even if you had done the research, we wouldn't expect you to come up with results any more valuable than any other researcher.
And why is that?
Dr. Luo, we're speaking frankly here. As I understand it, you're a failure of a scholar. You perform research not out of any thirst for exploration, nor out of a sense of duty and mission, but simply as a way to make a living.
Isn't that the way things are these days?
There's nothing wrong with that, of course. But you exhibit all kinds of behaviors unbecoming a serious and dedicated scholar. Your research is utilitarian, your techniques opportunistic. You seek out sensationalism, and you have a history of embezzling funding. Character-wise, you're cynical and irresponsible, and you harbor a mocking attitude toward a scholar's vocation. We're actually well aware of the fact that you don't care about the fate of the human race.
And that's why you would stoop to such despicable means to coerce me. You've despised me all along, haven't you?
Under normal circumstances, a man like you would never be tasked with such an important duty. But there is this one overriding detail. Tri Solaris is afraid of you. Be your own wall breaker. Find out why.
When Say finished, she stepped off the porch, got into the waiting car, and disappeared into the rainy mist. Standing there, Luoji lost his sense of time. Gradually, the rain stopped and the wind picked up, blowing the night sky free of clouds, revealing the snow peaks, and letting the bright round moon bathe the world in silvery light. Before going back inside, Luoji took one last look at the silver Garden of Eden, and his heart said to Zhuangyan and Xia Xia, "My love, wait for me at doomsday." Standing in the giant shadow cast by the space plane High Frontier and looking up at its massive body, Zhang Beihai was involuntarily reminded of the carrier Tong, now long dismantled, and even wondered if the hull of High Frontier could contain a few steel plates from Tong. Over the course of more than 30 re-entries, the burning heat had left scorch marks on the body of the space plane, and it really did look the way Tong had when it was under construction. The body had the same sense of age, but the two cylindrical booster rockets beneath the wings were new, making it resemble repairs to ancient architecture in Europe. The newness of the patches stood in stark contrast to the coloring of the original building, reminding visitors that those parts were modern additions. But if the boosters were removed, High Frontier would look like a big old transport plane. The space plane was a very new thing, one of the few breakthroughs in aerospace technology over the last 5 years, and quite possibly the last generation of chemically propelled spacecraft. The concept had been proposed the previous century as a replacement for the space shuttle that could take off from a runway like an ordinary plane and fly conventionally to the top layer of the atmosphere, at which point the rockets would be turned on for spaceflight and it would enter orbit. High Frontier was the fourth such spaceplane in operation, and many more were under construction. They would, in the near future, take on the task of building the space elevator.
"I once imagined that we would never get the chance to go to space in our lifetime,"
Zhang Beihai said to Chang Wei Si, who had come to see him off. He and 20 other Space Force officers, all of them members of the three strategic institutes, would take High Frontier to the ISS.
"Are there naval officers who've never been to sea?"
Chang Wei Si said, smiling.
"Of course there are. Lots of them. Some people in the Navy sought exactly that. But I'm not that sort of person." "Beihai, be aware of one thing. The active duty astronauts are still Air Force personnel, so you are the first representatives of the Space Force to go into space."
"It's a shame there's no specific mission."
"Experience is the mission. A space strategist ought to have a consciousness of space. This wasn't feasible before the space plane, since sending up one person cost tens of millions, but it's much cheaper now. We'll try to put more strategists into space soon, since we're the Space Force, after all. Right now, we're more like a college of bullshit, and that just won't do."
Then the boarding call was issued, and the officers began climbing the air stair to the plane. They wore uniforms, but not spacesuits, and looked no different than if they were taking standard air travel. It was a sign of progress, demonstrating that going to space was a little more normal than it had been. From the uniforms, Zhang Beihai noticed that there were people from other departments boarding the plane as well.
"Ah, Beihai, there's another important thing,"
Chang Wei-se said as Beihai was about to pick up his carry-on.
"The CMC has studied the report we submitted on sending political cadres to the future as reinforcements, and the brass feel that conditions are still premature."
Zhang Beihai squinted, as if warding against a glare, though they were still in the space plane's shadow.
"Commander, my feeling is that we ought to keep the entire four-century period in mind when making plans, and to be clear about what's urgent and what's important. But please be assured that I won't say that in any formal setting. I know very well that our superiors are considering the bigger picture."
"The higher-ups have affirmed your long-term thinking, and commend you for it. The document stresses one point. The plan to send reinforcements to the future has not been denied. Research and planning will continue, but present conditions are still premature for execution. I feel, and this is of course my personal opinion, that we need additional qualified political cadres in our ranks to lessen the current work pressures before we can consider it."
"Commander, surely you are aware of what qualified means in the context of the Space Force Political Department, and what the basic requirements are. Qualified people are becoming increasingly rare."
"But we've got to look forward. If there are breakthroughs in the two key technologies of Phase One, the space elevator and controlled fusion, and there's hope of this in our lifetimes, then things will be better."
"Okay then, off with you."
Zhang Beihai saluted him, and then stepped onto the stairs. His first feeling upon entering the cabin was that it wasn't much different than a civilian airliner, except the seats were wider, having been designed to accommodate spacesuits. During the first flights of the space plane, all passengers had to wear spacesuits as a precaution, but there was no need for that now. He had a window seat, and the seat immediately next to his was also occupied. A civilian, judging from his clothing. Zhang Beihai nodded to him in greeting, before turning his attention to fastening the seat's complicated safety belt. There was no countdown. High Frontier started its air engines and began taxiing. Because of its weight, it spent longer on the ground during takeoff than an ordinary plane, but at last it lifted ponderously off the ground and embarked on its voyage into space.
"This is the 38th flight of the space plane High Frontier. The aviation phase has started and will last approximately 30 minutes. Please do not unfasten your safety belts," said a voice over the intercom.
As he watched the ground recede through the cabin window, Zhang Beihai's thoughts turned to the past. During training to become a carrier captain, he had completed naval aviation pilot training and had passed the Level 3 fighter pilot exam. On his first solo trip, he had watched Earth recede like this, and suddenly discovered that he loved the sky even more deeply than the ocean. Now, his longing was for the space beyond the sky. He was a man destined to fly high and fly far.
"Not much different from civil aviation, you think?"
He turned to see the speaker sitting in the next seat, and recognized him at last.
"You must be Dr. Ding Yi. I've been wanting to meet you."
"But it's going to get rough in just a little bit," the man said, ignoring Zhang Beihai's salutation. He went on. "The first time, I didn't take off my glasses after the aviation phase, and they crushed my nose with the weight of a brick. The second time I took them off, but then they flew off after gravity went away. It wasn't easy for the guy to find them for me in the air filter in the plane's tail."
"I thought you went up on the space shuttle the first time. On TV, that didn't look like a very nice trip,"
Zhang Beihai said with a grin. Oh, I'm talking about taking the space plane. If we count the shuttle, then this is my fourth time. On the shuttle, they took away my glasses before takeoff.
Why are you going to the station this time? You've just been put in charge of a controlled fusion project. The third branch, isn't it?
Four branches had been set up for the controlled fusion project, each pursuing a different direction of research. Restrained by the safety belt, Ding Yi lifted a hand to point at Zhang Beihai.
You study controlled fusion and you can't go to space? You sound the same as those guys. The ultimate goal of our research is spaceship engines, and the real power held by the aerospace industry today remains to a large degree in the hands of the people who used to make chemical rocket engines. They're saying now that we're just supposed to devote ourselves to controlled fusion on the ground, and that we basically have no say in the general plan of the space fleet.
Dr. Ding, your views are identical to mine.
Zhang Beihai loosened his safety belt and leaned over.
For a space fleet, space travel is an entirely different concept from chemical rocketry. Even the space elevator is different from today's aerospace techniques. But right now, the aerospace industry of the past still holds too much power. Its people are ideologically ossified and legalistic, and if things continue, there will be all kinds of trouble.
There's nothing to be done. At least they've managed to come up with this in the course of 5 years.
He pointed around him.
And this gives them the capital to squeeze out outsiders.
The cabin intercom started up.
Please take care. We are approaching an altitude of 20,000 meters. Due to the thin atmosphere we will now be flying through, there may be sharp drops in altitude that will produce momentary weightlessness. Please do not panic. Again, please keep your safety belts fastened.
Ding Yi said, But our trip to the station this time is unrelated to the controlled fusion project. It's to recover those cosmic ray catchers. That's some expensive stuff.
The space-based high-energy physics research project has been stopped?
Asked Zhang Beihai, retightening his safety belt.
It's stopped. Knowing that there's no need to waste effort in the future counts as a kind of success.
The Sofons won.
That's right. So humanity only has a few reserves of theory remaining. Classical physics, quantum mechanics, and a still embryonic string theory. How far their applications can be pushed is up to fate.
High Frontier continued to climb, its aviation engines rumbling under the strain as if it were struggling up a tall mountain. But there were no sudden drops. The space plane was now approaching 30,000 meters, the limit of aviation. Looking out, Zhang Beihai saw that the blue of the sky was fading as it got dark, even though the sun became even more dazzling.
Our current flight altitude is 31,000 meters. The aviation phase is complete, and the space flight phase is about to begin. Please adjust your seats according to the illustration on screen to minimize the discomfort of hypergravitation.
Then Zhang Beihai felt the plane rise gently, as if it had discarded a burden.
Aircraft engine assembly separated. Aerospace engine ignition countdown. 10, 9, 8.
For them, this is the real launch. Enjoy,
Ding Yi said, and closed his eyes. When the countdown reached zero, there was a huge roar, as if the entire sky outside was shouting, and then hypergravity came like a giant, slowly tightening fist. With effort, Zhang Beihai twisted his head to look out the window. He was unable to see the flames spurting from the engine, but a wide swath of the rarefied air of the sky outside was painted red, as if High Frontier was floating through a sunset. 5 minutes later, the boosters detached, and after another 5 minutes of acceleration, the main engine cut off. High Frontier had entered orbit. The giant hand of hypergravity suddenly let go, and Zhang Beihai's body bounced back from the depths of his seat.
Although the restraint of his safety belt kept him from floating away, to his senses, he and the high frontier were no longer parts of the same whole. The gravity that had once bonded them together was gone, and he and the plane were now flying in parallel paths through space. Out the window were the brightest stars he had ever seen in his life. Later, when the space plane adjusted its attitude, the sun streamed in through the windows, and myriad points of light danced in its beams. Dust particles that had weightlessly taken to the air. As the plane gradually rotated, he saw the Earth. From this low orbital position, he couldn't see the entire sphere, only the arc of the horizon, but he could clearly make out the shapes of the continents. Then the star field, that long-awaited sight, finally came into view, and he said in his heart, "Dad, I've taken the first step." For 5 years, General Fitzroy had felt like a wall-facer in the actual sense of the word, in that the wall he faced was the big screen with the image of the stars between Earth and Trisolaris. At first glance, it was entirely black, but closer inspection of the screen revealed points of starlight. He had grown so well acquainted with those stars that when he had attempted to sketch their position on a piece of paper at a dull meeting the previous day, and compared it to the actual photo afterward, he was basically correct. The three stars of Trisolaris, lying inconspicuously at the center, looked like a single star in the standard view. But every time he magnified them, he found that their positions had changed. This chaotic cosmic dance so fascinated him that he forgot what he was looking for in the first place. The brush that had been observed 5 years ago had gradually faded away, and no second brush had appeared. The Trisolaran fleet left a visible wake only when it passed through interstellar dust clouds. Earth's astronomers had verified through observations of the absorption of background starlight that during the fleet's 4-century-long voyage through space, it would pass through 5 of them. People dubbed these snow patches after the way that passers-by left tracks on snowy ground. If the Trisolaran fleet had maintained a constant acceleration over the past 5 years, it would pass the second snow patch today. Fitzroy arrived at the Hubble 2 Space Telescope Control Center early. Ringier laughed when he saw him.
"General, why do you remind me of a child who wants another present so soon after Christmas?"
"Didn't you say that they would cross the snow patch today?"
"That's right. But the Trisolaran fleet has only traveled 0.22 light-years, so it's still 4 light-years away. Light reflected from its passage through the snow won't reach Earth for another 4 years."
"Oh, I'm sorry. I forgot about that,"
Fitzroy said with an embarrassed shake of his head.
"I really wanted to see them again. This time, we'll be able to measure their speed and acceleration at the time of passage, and that's very important."
"I'm sorry. We're outside the light cone."
"What's that?"
"It's what physicists call the cone shape that light describes as it emanates along the time axis. It's impossible for people outside the cone to comprehend events taking place inside the cone. Think about it. Information about who knows how many major events in the universe is flying toward us right now at the speed of light. Some of it has been traveling for hundreds of millions of years, but we're still outside the light cones of those events."
"Fate lies within the light cone."
Ringier considered this, then gave him an appreciative nod.
"General, that's an excellent analogy. But sophons outside the light cone can see events on the inside."
"So the sophons have changed fate,"
Fitzroy said with feeling, and turned back to an image processing terminal. 5 years before, the young engineer Harris had started to cry at the sight of the brush, and afterward had suffered from depression so severe that he became practically useless at his job and was let go. No one knew where he had ended up. Fortunately, there weren't many people like him. Temperatures were cooling rapidly these days, and it had started to snow, causing the green to gradually disappear from the surrounding area, and a thin layer of ice to freeze on the surface of the lake. Nature lost its bright coloring, like a color photograph turned black and white. Warm weather here had always been short-lived, but to Luoji, the Garden of Eden felt like it had lost its aura since the departure of his wife and child. Winter was a season for thinking. When Luoji began to think, he was surprised to find that his thoughts were already in progress. He remembered back to middle school and a lesson a teacher had taught him for language arts exams. First, take a look at the final essay question, then start the exam from the top, so that as you work on the exam, your subconscious will be thinking over the essay question, like a background process in a computer. Now he knew that from the moment he became a wall facer, his thinking had started up and had never stopped. The entire process was subconscious, and he had never been aware of it. He quickly retraced the steps his thoughts had already completed. He was now certain that everything about his current situation stemmed from his chance encounter with Ye Wenjie 9 years ago. Afterward, he had never spoken of the meeting with anyone for fear of causing unnecessary trouble for himself. But with Ye Wenjie gone, the meeting was a secret known only to him and Tri Solaris. In those days, only 2 Sofons had reached Earth, but he could be certain that on that evening, they had been there by Yang Dong's grave, listening to their every word. And the fluctuation in their quantum formation that instantly crossed the space of 4 light years meant that Tri Solaris had also been listening. But what had Ye Wenjie said? Secretary General Sei had been wrong about one thing. Luoji's never-begun research into cosmic sociology was quite likely the immediate reason why Tri Solaris wanted to kill him. Of course, Sei didn't know that the project had been Ye Wenjie's suggestion, and although had just seemed to Luoji like an excellent opportunity to make scholarship entertaining, he had been looking for just such an opportunity. Prior to the Tri-Solar Crisis, the study of alien civilization was indeed a sensational project that would have garnered easy media attention. The aborted research project wasn't important in and of itself. What mattered was the instruction that Ye Wenjie had given him. So that's where Luoji's mind was stuck. Over and over again, he recalled her words. Suppose a vast number of civilizations are distributed throughout the universe, on the order of the number of detectable stars. Lots and lots of them. The mathematical structure of cosmic sociology is far clearer than that of human sociology. The factors of chaos and randomness in the complex makeups of every civilized society in the universe get filtered out by the immense distance, so those civilizations can act as reference points that are relatively easy to manipulate mathematically. First, survival is the primary need of civilization. Second, civilization continuously grows and expands, but the total matter in the universe remains constant. One more thing. To derive a basic picture of cosmic sociology from these 2 axioms, you need 2 other important concepts: chains of suspicion and the technological explosion. I'm afraid there won't be that opportunity. Well, you might as well just forget I said anything. Either way, I've fulfilled my duty. He had returned countless times to these words, analyzing each sentence from every angle and chewing over every word. The component words had been strung into a set of prayer beads, and like a pious monk, he stroked them time and again, and unstrung them, scattered them, and restrung them in different orders until a layer of each had been worn away. Try as he might,
he couldn't extract the clue from those words. The clue that made him the only person that Tri-Solaris wanted to destroy. During his lengthy contemplation, he strolled aimlessly. He walked along the desolate lakeside, walked through the wind as it grew ever colder, oftentimes completing a circuit of the lake unawares. Twice, he even walked to the foot of the snow peak, where the patch of exposed rock that looked like a moonscape was blanketed with snow, becoming one with the snow cap ahead of him. Only then did his mood leave the track of his thoughts, Zhuang Yan's eyes appearing before his own in the boundless blank white of the natural painting. But he was now able to keep his mood in check and continue turning himself into a thinking machine. A month went by without him knowing it, and then winter came in full force. But he still conducted his lengthy thought process outside, sharpening his mind on the cold. By this time, most of the prayer beads had been worn faint, except for 21 of them. These ones seemed only to get newer the more he polished them, and now emitted a faint light. Survival is the primary need of civilization. Civilization continuously grows and expands, but the total matter in the universe remains constant. He fixated on these two sentences, the axioms Ye Wenjie had proposed for cosmic civilization. Although he did not know their ultimate secret, his long meditation told him that the answer lay within them. But it was too simple a clue. What could he and the human race gain from two self-evident rules? Don't dismiss simplicity. Simple means solid. The entire mansion of mathematics was erected on a foundation of this kind of irreducibly simple, yet logically rock-solid axiom. With this in mind, he looked around him. All that surrounded him was huddled up against the icy cold of winter, but most of the world still teemed with life. It was a living world brimming with a complex profusion of oceans, land, and sky as vast as the foggy sea. But all of it ran according to a rule even simpler than the axioms of cosmic civilization. Survival of the fittest. Luoji now saw his problem. Where Darwin had taken the boundless living world and made a rule to sum it up, Luoji had to use the rules he knew to uncover a picture of cosmic civilization. It was the opposite road to Darwin's, but a more difficult one. So he began sleeping in the daytime and thinking at night. Whenever the perils of his mental roadway terrified him, he found comfort in the stars overhead. Like Ye Wenjie had said, the distance hid the complex structure of each star, making them just a collection of points in space with a clear mathematical configuration. It was a thinker's paradise, his paradise. To Luoji, at least, it felt like the world in front of him was far clearer and more concise than Darwin's. But this simple world held a perplexing riddle. The entire galaxy was a vast empty desert, but a highly intelligent civilization had appeared on the star nearest to us. In this mystery, his thoughts found an entry point. Gradually, the two concepts Ye Wenjie had left unexplained came into focus. Chains of suspicion and the technology explosion. The weather that day was colder than usual, and from Luoji's vantage point on the lakeshore, the cold seemed to make the stars into an even purer silver lattice against the black sky, solemnly displaying for him their clear mathematical configuration. All of a sudden, he found himself in a state that was entirely new. In his perception, the entire universe froze, all motion stopped, and everything from stars down to atoms entered a state of rest, with the stars just countless, cold, dimensionless points reflecting the cold light of an outside world. Everything was at rest, waiting for his final awakening. The distant bark of a dog brought him back to reality. Probably a service canine belonging to the security forces. Luoji was beside himself with excitement. Although he hadn't actually glimpsed that final mystery, he had clearly felt its presence just now. He collected his thoughts and tried to re-enter that state, but was unsuccessful. Though the stars remained the same, the world around him interfered with his thinking. All was shrouded in darkness, but he could make out the distant snow cap, the lakeside forest and grassland, and the house behind him. And through the house's half-open door, he could see the dark glow of the fire. Next to the simple clarity of the stars, everything in the vicinity represented a complexity and chaos that mathematics would be forever unable to grasp, so he attempted to remove them from his perception. He walked out onto the frozen lake, cautiously at first, but when he found that the icy surface seemed solid, he walked and slid ahead more quickly, until he reached a point where he could no longer make out the lakeshore through the night around him. Now he was surrounded on all sides by smooth ice. This distanced him somewhat from earthly complexity and chaos, and by imagining that the icy plain extended infinitely in every direction, he obtained a simple, flat world. A cold, planar mental platform. Cares vanished, and soon his perception re-entered that state of rest, where the stars were waiting for him. Then, with a crunch, the ice beneath Luoji's feet broke, and his body plunged straight into the water. At the precise instant the icy water covered Luoji's head, he saw the stillness of the stars shatter. The star field curled up into a vortex and scattered into turbulent, chaotic waves of silver. The biting cold, like crystal lightning, shot into the fog of his consciousness, illuminating everything. He continued to sink. The turbulent stars overhead shrank into a fuzzy halo at the break in the ice above his head, leaving nothing but cold and inky blackness surrounding him, as if he wasn't sinking into ice water, but had jumped into the blackness of space. In the dead, lonely, cold blackness, he saw the truth of the universe. He surfaced quickly. His head surged out of the water, and he spat out a mouthful. He tried crawling onto the ice at the edge of the hole, but could only bring his body up halfway before the ice collapsed again. He crawled and collapsed, forging a path through the ice, but progress was slow, and his stamina began to give out from the cold. He didn't know whether the security team would notice anything unusual on the lake before he drowned or froze to death. Stripping off his soaked-down jacket to lessen the burden on his movement, he had the idea that if he spread out the jacket on the ice, it might distribute the pressure and allow him to crawl onto it. He did so, and then, with just enough energy left for one last attempt, he used every last ounce of strength to crawl onto the down jacket at the edge of the ice. This time the ice didn't collapse, and at last his entire body was lying on top of it. He crept carefully ahead, daring to stand up only after putting a fair distance between him and the hole. Then he saw flashlights waving on the shore and heard shouts. He stood on the ice, his teeth chattering in the cold, a cold that seemed to come not from the lake water or icy wind, but from a direct transmission from outer space. He kept his head down, knowing that from this moment on, the stars were not like they once were. He didn't dare look up. As Ray Diaz feared the sun, Luoji had acquired a severe phobia of the stars. He bowed his head, and through chattering teeth, said to himself,
"Wallfacer Luoji, I am your wallbreaker."
"Your hair's turned white over the years.
Luoji said to Kent.
For many years to come, at least. It's not going to get any whiter, Kent said, laughing.
In Luoji's presence, he had always worn a courteous, studied face. This was the first time Luoji had seen him with such a sincere smile. In his eyes, he saw the words that remained unspoken. You've finally begun to work.
I need someplace safer, he said.
Not a problem, Dr. Luo. Any particular requests?
Nothing apart from safety. It must be absolutely secure.
Doctor, an absolutely safe place does not exist, but we can come very close. I'll have to warn you, though. These places are always underground, and as for comfort, disregard comfort. However, it'd be best if it's in China.
Not a problem. I'll take care of it immediately.
When Kent was about to leave, Luoji stopped him. Pointing out the window at the Garden of Eden, which was now completely blanketed in snow, he said,
Can you tell me the name of this place? I'm going to miss it.
Luoji traveled more than 10 hours under tight security before reaching his destination. When he exited the car, he knew immediately where he was. It was here, in the broad, squat hall that looked like an underground parking garage, that he had embarked on his fantastic new life 5 years before. Now, after 5 years of dreams alternating with nightmares, he had returned to the starting point. Greeting him was a man named Zhang Xiang, the same young man who, along with Shi Qiang, had sent him off 5 years ago, and who now was in charge of security. He had aged considerably in 5 years, and now looked like a middle-aged man. The elevator was still operated by an armed soldier, not the one from back then, of course, but Luoji still felt a certain warmth in his heart. The old-style elevator had been swapped for one that was completely automated and did not require an operator, so the soldier merely pressed the -10 button, and the elevator started its descent. The underground structure had clearly undergone a recent renovation. The ventilation ducts in the hallways had been hidden, the walls coated with moisture-proof tile, and all traces of the civil air defense slogans had disappeared. Luoji's living quarters took up the whole of the 10th basement floor. While it was no match in comfort for the house he had just left, it was equipped with comprehensive communications and computer equipment, along with a conference room set up with a remote video conferencing system, giving the place the feel of a command center. The administrator made a particular point of showing Luoji a set of light switches in the room, each of which bore a small picture of the sun. The administrator called them sun lamps and said they needed to be turned on for no fewer than 5 hours a day. Originally intended as labor safety products for mine workers, they could simulate sunlight, including UV rays, as supplementary daylight for people spending long periods underground. The next day, as Luoji had requested, the astronomer Albert Ringier visited the 10th basement. When he saw him, Luoji said,
You were the first to observe the flight path of the Trisolaran fleet?
Ringier looked a little unhappy to hear this.
I've repeatedly issued statements to reporters, but they insist on forcing this honor on my head. It should be credited to General Fitzroy. He was the one who demanded that Hubble 2 observe Trisolaris during testing. Otherwise, we might have missed the chance, since the wake in the interstellar dust would have faded.
What I'd like to talk to you about isn't connected to that. I did a bit of astronomy once, but not in much depth, and I'm no longer familiar with the subject. My first question is this. If, in the universe, there exists another observer apart from Trisolaris, has Earth's position been revealed to them?
No.
You're sure of that?
Yes.
But Earth has exchanged communication with Trisolaris.
That low-frequency communication
would reveal only the general direction of Earth and Trisolaris in the Milky Way galaxy, and the distance between the two worlds. That is, if there's a third-party recipient, the communication would make it possible for them to know of the existence of two civilized worlds 4.22 light-years apart in the Orion arm of the Milky Way, but they would still be ignorant of the precise position of those two worlds. In fact, determining each other's position through this kind of exchange is only feasible for stars in close proximity, like the Sun and the stars of Trisolaris. For a slightly more distant third-party observer, however, even if we communicate directly with them, we wouldn't be able to determine each other's position.
Why is that?
Marking the position of a star for another observer in the universe is hardly as easy as people imagine. Here's an analogy. You're taking a plane through the Sahara Desert, and a grain of sand below you shouts, "Here I am." You hear the shout, but can you fix a location for that grain of sand from the plane? There are nearly 200 billion stars in the Milky Way. It's practically a desert of stars.
Luoji nodded in apparent relief. I understand. So that's it, then.
What is? Ringye asked in confusion.
Luoji didn't answer, but asked instead, using our present level of technology, is there a way to indicate the position of a star in the universe?
Yes, by using directed very high-frequency electromagnetic waves, equal to or higher in frequency than visible light, and then harnessing stellar power to transmit information. In simple terms, you'd make the star flash, like a cosmic lighthouse.
This far exceeds our present technical capabilities.
Oh, I'm sorry. I overlooked your precondition. At our present technical capabilities, it would be fairly difficult to show a star's position to the far reaches of the universe. There's still a way, but interpreting the positional information requires a level of technology far beyond that of humanity, and even, I believe, beyond that of Trisolaris.
Tell me about that approach.
The key information is the relative position of stars. If you specify a region of space in the Milky Way that contains a sufficient number of stars, perhaps a few dozen would be sufficient, their relative arrangement in three-dimensional space would be totally unique, like a fingerprint.
I'm starting to understand. We send out a message containing the position of the star we wish to point out, relative to the surrounding stars, and the recipient compares the data to its star map to determine the star's location.
Right. But things aren't that simple. The recipient must possess a three-dimensional model of the entire galaxy that precisely indicates the relative position of every one of 100 billion stars. Then, after receiving our message, they would have to search through that enormous database to find an area of space that matches the pattern of positions we sent out.
No, it's not simple at all. It's like recording the relative position of every grain of sand in the desert.
Even harder than that. The Milky Way, unlike the desert, is in motion, and the relative positions of its stars are constantly changing. The later the position information is received, the greater the error caused by these changes. This means the database has to be able to predict the changes in position of each of those 100 billion stars. In theory, it's not a problem, but to actually do it, God.
Would it be hard for us to send that positional information?
No, because we would only need to have a position pattern for a limited number of stars. And now that I've had time to think about it, given the average stellar density of the outer arm of the galaxy, a position pattern with no more than 30 stars should be sufficient. That's a small amount of information.
Good. Now I'll ask a third question. Outside the solar system, there are other stars with planets. You've discovered several hundred, right?
More than 1,000 to date.
And the closest to the Sun?
244J2E1, 16 light-years from the Sun.
As I remember it, the serial numbers are set like this. The prefix digits represent the order of discovery. The letters J, E, and X stand for Jupiter-type planets, Earth-type planets, and other planets, respectively. And the digits following the letter indicate the number of that type of planet in the system. That's right. 244J2E1 is a star with three planets, two of them Jupiter-type and one Earth-type. Luoji thought for a moment, then shook his head.
That's too close. How about a little farther, like around 50 light-years?
187J3X1, 49.5 light-years from the Sun.
That one's fine. Can you draw up a position pattern for that star?
Of course I can.
How long would it take? Would you need help?
I can do it here if there's a computer with internet. For a pattern of, say, 30 stars, I can give it to you tonight.
What time is it now? It's not nighttime already?
I'd say it's probably morning, Dr. Luo.
Ringye went to the computer room next door, and Luoji called in Kent and Zhang Xiang. He first explained to Kent that he wanted the PDC to hold the next wall facer hearing as soon as possible.
Kent said, "There are lots of PDC meetings these days. Once you've submitted the application, you'll probably only have to wait a few days."
"Then I'll have to wait, but I'd really like it as soon as possible. Also, I have a request, to attend the hearing here via video rather than go to the UN.
Kent looked reluctant.
"Dr. Luo, don't you think that's a little inappropriate? For such a high-level international meeting, it's a question of respect for the participants."
"It's part of the plan. All those bizarre requests I made in the past were fulfilled, but this one's over the line?"
"You know," Kent faltered, "I know that a wall facer's status isn't like it once was, but I insist on this."
When he continued, it was in a softer voice, even though he knew that the sofons hanging in the vicinity could still hear.
"There are two possibilities now. One, if everything is like it used to be, I wouldn't mind going to the UN. But there's another possibility. I may be in a very dangerous situation, and I can't take that risk."
Then he said to Zhang Xiang, "That's why I've brought you here. We may become a target for a concentrated enemy attack, so security must be strengthened."
"Don't worry, Dr. Luo. We're located 200 meters below ground. The area above us is under lockdown, an anti-missile system has been deployed, and a state-of-the-art subterranean warning system has been installed to detect the digging of a tunnel from any direction. I guarantee to you that our security is foolproof."
When the two men left, Luoji took a walk down the hallway, his thoughts turning involuntarily to the Garden of Eden. He knew its name now, but still called it that in his heart, and its lake and snow peak. He knew that it was quite likely he would spend the rest of his life underground. He looked around at the sun lamps in the hallway ceiling. The light they emitted was nothing like the sun. Two meteors moved slowly across the starfield. All was dark on the ground, and the distant horizon blended into one with the night sky. A burst of whispers sounded through the dark, although the speakers remained unseen, as if the voices themselves were invisible creatures floating in the darkness. With a clink, a small flame appeared in the darkness, its dim light revealing three faces: Qin Shi Huang, Aristotle, and von Neumann. The flame came from a lighter in Aristotle's hand. When a few torches were extended, he lit one, which then passed fire among the others to form a shaky light in the wilderness and illuminate a group of people drawn from every era. Their whispers continued. Qin Shi Huang leapt up on a stone and brandished his sword, and the crowd fell silent.
"The Lord has issued a new command. Destroy Wallfacer Luoji," he said.
"We too have received this command.
This is the second assassination order that the Lord has issued for Luoji,
Mortzer said.
But it will be difficult to kill him now,
someone said.
Difficult? It's impossible. If Evans hadn't added that condition to the first assassination order, he would have been dead 5 years ago.
Perhaps Evans was right to do so. After all, we don't know his reasons. Luoji was lucky to escape a second time in the UN Plaza.
Qin Shi Huang stopped the debate with a wave of his sword.
Shall we talk instead about what to do? There's nothing we can do. Who can even get anywhere near a bunker 200 meters deep, much less get inside? It's guarded too tightly.
Shall we consider nuclear weapons?
The place is an anti-nuke bunker from the Cold War, dammit.
The only viable option is sending someone to infiltrate security.
Can that be done? We've had years. Has there ever been a successful infiltration?
Infiltrate his kitchen!
This prompted some laughter.
Cut the crap! The Lord ought to tell us the truth, and maybe we can come up with a better option.
Qin Shi Huang answered the last speaker.
I also made that request, but the Lord said the truth was the most important secret in the universe and could not be revealed.
The Lord spoke of it with Evans under the impression that humanity already knew, but later learned otherwise.
Then ask the Lord to transfer technology.
Many other voices echoed this.
Qin Shi Huang said,
This was another request I made. To my surprise, the Lord uncharacteristically did not reject it entirely.
A commotion took hold of the crowd, but Qin Shi Huang's next words quieted the excitement. But once the Lord learned the location of the target, the request was swiftly rejected. It said that as far as the target's location was concerned, any technology it would transfer to us would be ineffective.
Is he really that important?
Von Neumann asked, unable to conceal a note of jealousy in his voice. As the first successful wall-breaker, he had risen rapidly in the organization.
The Lord is afraid of him.
Einstein said,
I have thought this over for a long time, and I believe that the Lord's fear of Luoji has only one possible reason. He is the mouthpiece of certain power.
Qin Shi Huang shut down further discussion on the subject.
Don't get into that. Instead, let's think of how to fulfill the Lord's command.
It can't be done. It really can't be done. It's a mission that can't be completed.
Qin Shi Huang clanged his sword on the rock beneath his feet.
This mission is crucial. The Lord may really be under threat. Besides, if we complete it, the organization will be greatly elevated in the Lord's eyes. Gathered here are the elite of every sphere throughout the world. So how can we fail to think of something? Go back and think it over, and send your plans here to me through other channels. We've got to get on this.
The torches burned out in succession, and darkness swallowed everything. But the whispering went on. The PDC Wallfacer Project hearing did not convene for 2 weeks. After Tyler's failure and the hibernation of the other two Wallfacers, the PDC's main priority and attention had turned to mainstream defense. Luoji and Kent awaited the start of the meeting in the video conference room. The conference video connection had been made, and the big screen displayed the PDC auditorium, where the circular table familiar from the Security Council days was still completely empty. Luoji had arrived early as something of an apology for not attending in person. While they waited, he chatted with Kent and asked him how he was managing. Kent said that he had lived in China for 3 years when he was younger, so he was quite accustomed to it and was doing well. At any rate, he didn't have to spend all day underground like Luoji, and his rusty Chinese had recently regained its fluency.
You sound like you have a cold, Luoji said.
I've just caught the bed flu, he replied.
Bird flu? Luoji said in alarm.
No, bed flu. That's what the media's calling it. It started going around in a nearby city a week ago. It's infectious, but symptoms are light. There's no fever, just a runny nose, and some patients get a sore throat. There's no need for medication, and it goes away on its own in 3 days or so, after a little bed rest.
The flu is usually more serious than that.
Not this time. A lot of soldiers and staff here have already been infected. Haven't you noticed that they replaced the caretaker? She caught the bed flu too, but was afraid of giving it to you. But, as your liaison, I can't be replaced for the time being.
On screen, the national delegates had begun to enter the auditorium. They sat down and started talking in low voices, as if they hadn't noticed Luoji's presence. The incumbent rotating chair of the PDC opened the meeting, saying,
Wallfacer Luoji, the Wallfacer Act was amended at the special session of the UN General Assembly that just adjourned. You've seen it?
Yes, he answered.
Then you must have noticed that the Act strengthens the examinations and restrictions on Wallfacer resource allocation. I hope that the plan you will submit to the hearing today will comply with the Act's requirements.
Mr. Chair, Luoji said, the other three Wallfacers have allocated an enormous amount of resources to the execution of their own strategic plans. To limit my plan's resources in this way is unfair.
Resource allocation privileges depend on the plan itself, and you must be aware that the other three Wallfacer plans are not in conflict with mainstream defense. In other words, the research and engineering they are conducting would have been carried out even without the Wallfacer project. I hope that your strategic plan is also of this nature.
I'm sorry to say that my plan is not of this nature. It has absolutely nothing to do with mainstream defense.
Then I'm sorry too. Under the new Act, the resources you can allocate to this plan are very limited.
Even under the old plan, I couldn't allocate all that much. However, this isn't a problem, Mr. Chair. My strategic plan consumes practically no resources at all.
Just like your previous plans?
The chair's remark prompted snickers from several participants. Even less than in the past. Like I said, it consumes practically no resources at all, he said simply.
Then let's have a look,
the chair said, nodding. The specifics of the plan will be introduced by Dr. Albert Ringier, although I presume you all received the corresponding file. To sum up, using the radio wave magnification capabilities of the sun, a message will be sent into the cosmos containing three simple images, along with additional information to demonstrate that these images have been sent by an intelligence as opposed to occurring naturally. The images are included in the file. The sound of rustling paper filled the auditorium as the attendees located the three sheets. The images were also displayed on the screen. They were quite simple. Each consisted of black dots, seemingly scattered at random, but they all noticed that each image contained one conspicuously larger dot that was marked with an arrow.
What is it?
Asked the U.S. representative, who, like the rest of the attendees, was inspecting the images carefully.
Wallfacer Luoji, according to the basic principles of the Wallfacer project, you do not need to answer that question,
the chair said. It's a spell, he said. The rustling and murmuring in the auditorium stopped abruptly. Everyone looked up in the same direction, so that Luoji now knew the location of the screen displaying his feed.
What?
Asked the chair, with narrowed eyes.
He said it's a spell,
someone seated at the circular table said loudly.
A spell against whom?
Luoji answered. Against the planets of star 187J3X1. Of course, it could also work directly against the star itself.
What effect will it have?
That's unknown right now. But one thing is certain. The effect of the spell will be catastrophic.
Is there a chance these planets have life?
I consulted repeatedly with the astronomical community on that point. From present observational data, the answer is no, Luoji said, narrowing his eyes like the chair had. He prayed silently. May they be right.
After the spell is sent out, how long will it take to work?
The star is around 50 light-years from the sun, so the spell will complete in 50 years at the earliest, but we won't be able to observe its effects for 100 years. This is just the earliest